This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
You have seen food prices going up at the local grocery store. That could be just the beginning. According to Lester Brown, a leading expert in both the environment and world agriculture, those bulging supermarket shelves are part of a food bubble, which could crash. Lester Brown founded the World Watch Institute with its annual State of the World reports. You've seen those. He's written 50 books, won many honors. He's recognized as a thought leader. Now in his own Earth Policy Institute, Brown's new book is World on Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Lester Brown, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure, Alex.
Well, you've been a resource and inspiration to me for years, but our time is limited, so let's dive right into the important issues we face. What is the food bubble, and how does it compare to the real estate bubble?
The real estate bubble, which most Americans are familiar with at this point, was the result of overlending, lending to people who were not really qualified or capable of paying their mortgages. The food bubble is the result of overplowing and overpumping, particularly overpumping. The real estate bubble was a U.S. phenomenon, but it was so big that it sent shockwaves throughout the world economy. And incidentally, when the real estate bubble burst, housing prices in this country dropped 30%. When the food bubble burst, and it's already bursting in a few countries that have been overpumping and overplowing, it leads to price rises, and we will see very substantial rises in food prices. Indeed, are already seeing those.
We've seen some shocking weather events which fit predictions for rapid climate change, the Russian heat wave, the disastrous floods in Pakistan, and right now in Queensland, Australia. Is climate destabilizing world food production already?
We have seen in the past grain price surges when there was some event somewhere in the world. It could be a monsoon failure in India or heat wave in Russia or the former Soviet Union or drought in the U.S. Midwest. But what we're looking at now is more extreme climate events, heat waves, floods, storms, etc. And one of the problems we face is it used to be if there was an event someplace in the world that led to a tightening of grain supplies, we would just wait a year or so, or the U.S. would bring some idled cropland back into production, and then within a year things would be back to norm. Well, a couple things have changed. One, we don't have the idled cropland in the United States anymore to bring back into production when things tighten. So we've lost that cushion, that reserve, as it were. The second thing is that with climate now changing, the whole system is changing. There's no norm to go back to. And that, I think, we have not yet quite realized. There's still, I think, a feeling that, you know, if we're patient, things will go back to normal. But there is no normal with climate anymore. It's in constant change now.
Well, what about peak oil, so-called, or rising oil prices and agriculture?
There's always been, in the modern era at least, a link between rising oil prices and grain production costs and food production costs generally, because oil is involved in the production and the transport, the processing, and so forth of food. And that still exists. But there's another link now. Given the capacity we have to convert grain into oil, i.e. ethanol, to fuel cars, the price of grain is now tied to the price of oil. As the price of oil goes up, it becomes more profitable to convert grain into ethanol. And so, given the development of that capacity, particularly in the United States, where this year something like 119 million tons of grain out of our harvest of roughly 400 million tons, will be going to ethanol distilleries. So what we have created in the world is a situation where the price of grain is now tied to the price of oil, and we know that the long-term price of oil is going to be going up. And therefore, in the absence of government intervention, that is, in the form of restrictions on converting grain into ethanol, the price of grain will follow the price of oil upward.
Lester Brown, in your work, you draw a distinction between problems that are event-driven and those that are trend-driven. Can you explain this and give us examples of trends to watch?
Well, an event-driven tightening of grain supplies would be the heat wave in Russia. A trend-driven tightening of food supplies would be shrinking irrigation water supplies, for example, in many countries. Water tables are now falling in countries that contain half the world's people. and that includes the big three grain producers, China, India, and the United States, and includes a number of smaller countries. Wheat production in Saudi Arabia, which was self-sufficient in wheat for more than 20 years, is now in free fall. It's collapsing because all of their irrigation water was coming from a fossil aquifer. That is an aquifer that does not recharge. So once it's depleted, that's it. So we've seen the Saudi grain harvest drop from about 3 million tons a year as recently as 2007 to less than 1 million tons this year. And within another couple of years, they'll probably be out of wheat production altogether and totally dependent on grain imports. According to World Bank figures, 175 million people who live in India are being fed with grain produced by overpumping, which by definition is a short-term phenomenon. Our estimates for China are that 130 million Chinese are being fed with grain produced by overpumping. Here in the United States, we know that irrigated area is shrinking in key agricultural states like California, Texas, many other states, including Colorado, for example. So it's quite possible that we don't have good enough data to be certain. It's quite possible that we have passed peak water, peak irrigation, before we pass peak oil. But both will profoundly influence the future of agriculture and world food prices.
What is our food situation now? How good are our reserves? And are people dying due to lack of food, but we just don't hear about it in the media?
One of the things that's happened over the last half century is that famine has been redefined. There was a time when famine was a geographic phenomenon. Wherever there was a poor harvest in the world, there was often the risk of famine. But we have developed an international food distribution system now, not just the market economy, though that's an important part of it, but also the World Food Program, where the UN's World Food Program has relief efforts, I think, in 29 countries right now. And so we have these ways of intervening to avoid a geographic famine, that is, thousands or even millions of people dying in a particular area. But what has happened is that we have redefined famine and made it an economic phenomenon. It's the low-income people in the world, those who get by on $1 or $2 a day, where they may have only two meals. There's some place in the world where families are trying to get by with just one meal a day. And that's really getting pretty close to the edge. So it's estimated that something like 17,000 children die each year, that is children 5 years and below, as a result of malnutrition. And that, when you begin to calculate for the year, comes to, as I recall, 7 or 8 million. So hunger has not left us. It's just it's concentrated in economic groups instead of geographic regions.
In some food-challenged countries, I could name Pakistan among many, malnutrition and starvation are experienced by women first. Can you talk about the importance of gender in the food crisis?
Well, I was hearing a conversation about this at a social gathering just recently. In many developing countries, particularly in Asia and the Middle East and in parts of Africa, the males are fed first and the females are fed afterwards. So there's a tendency to have more malnutrition among girls than among boys, for example. And the same is true for differences in education. If boys usually get priority and then girls go to school if it works out, but they don't get the same consideration. So one of the keys to breaking out of this situation is making sure that, one, that we educate all youngsters, girls as well as boys, and another is to make sure that children everywhere are adequately nourished, because it's a key to their future, not just physical, but mental development as well.
But let me be a bit of a devil's advocate here. I mean, scholars like Dr. Bill Reese, the co-inventor of the ecological footprint, he says the world is already at least 30% beyond its carrying capacity. We've just gone over 7 billion people. Should we try to expand global food production infinitely? Where is population control or even population reduction in all of this?
It's not getting nearly the attention it deserves. Tonight, there will be 219,000 people at the dinner table who were not there last night. And tomorrow night, there will be another 219,000. Many of them, incidentally, with empty plates. And it's this relentless growth of population that's been underway for more than half a century now that is taxing the skills of farmers and the limits of the Earth's land and water resources. And for some reason, particularly the last couple of decades, we've let the population issue fall off the table. And it's coming back on now, and that's the good news. But there are roughly 205 million women in the world who want to plan their families but lack access to the family planning services needed to do so. Now, the cost of filling that gap is minuscule compared with military expenditures, for example. I mean, the cost of doing that would get lost in the rounding of our military budget. It's so small. But it's one of the most central investments we can make. These are not women who need to be convinced. And incidentally, they and their families represent over a billion people, well over a billion people, because it would be at least an average of five people per family for each of these women. So getting the resources to them, they want to plan their families. You don't have to convince them. They just don't have the resources. And it's almost a crime against humanity and certainly a threat to our future not to fill that family planning gap.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Lester Brown from the Earth Policy Institute. We're talking about a world on edge. Lester, how soon and how serious could a food crisis be?
First, I would say that in looking at the future of civilization, I mean, it's interesting, we environmentalists used to talk about saving the planet, but as I think about it, the planet's probably going to be around for some time. The question is, will civilization survive the stresses that are beginning to build? That's the real issue. And it seems to me, though I have long rejected this idea, that food may be the weak link in the system, just as it was for the earlier civilizations whose archaeological sites we now study, you know, the Sumerians, the Mayans, and so forth. Food was the weak link for them, and it also, I think, is going to be the weak link for us. How soon it could be. You know, there's a tendency to think that we've got problems, but they won't really become serious until 20 years from now or by 2050 or, you know, the end of this century or sometime. I think we could be in trouble very quickly, as early as this year, for example. I mean, I don't think it's decades away. I think it could happen any year now. And I would just cite as an example, the heat wave in Russia last summer, when the temperature in Moscow for the month of July was 14 degrees Fahrenheit above the norm, Russia lost 40% of its grain crop. It was hoping for close to 100 million tons of grain. It lost 40 million tons, harvested about 60 million tons. Now, that led to a 60% increase in wheat prices within just a few months. But in a sense, the world was fortunate, because if that heat wave had been centered in Chicago instead of Moscow, and the U.S. had lost 40% of its grain harvest, we would have lost 40%, not of 100 million tons, but of 400 million tons. So the world would have lost 160 million tons of grain from this past year's harvest. That would have created chaos in world grain markets. It would have dropped grain stocks to the lowest level in history, well below what they were 3 years ago in 2007, 2008, when grain prices set historic highs. If that heat wave had been centered in Chicago, grain prices would have gone off the top of the chart. Food prices would have started rising everywhere. Grain exporting countries would have begun restricting exports, or in some cases even banning them altogether, as Russia and Argentina did with wheat in 2007, 2008, and as Vietnam, the number two rice exporter, did with rice, and a number of other countries as well. So we would have grain exporting countries restricting exports to try to keep their food prices under control. And then the next thing would have happened is the oil exporting countries would have tried to barter oil for grain in order to make sure they could get the grain they wanted. And then the rest of the world would have been on its own, because there's no guarantee anymore that the world market will supply grain just because you need it. And so there's been this loss of confidence in the market, and we could quickly move into a chaotic situation where, instead of watching the smoke and the fires and so forth in and around Moscow on the evening news, we would have been watching food riots in scores of countries around the world. Governments would be falling. and more states would be failing. And the loss of confidence in the world market, we forget that there's a certain amount of confidence that makes the world market and the world economy function. When you lose that confidence in the market, then things begin to unravel pretty fast. And that's how close to the edge we are right now.
Well, Lester Brown, in addition to tracking a number of threats, you are famous for doggedly presenting solutions, including the book Plan B, now updated to version 4.0. Can you briefly outline just a couple of the solutions to these problems?
Well, one of the things we need to do is to cut carbon emissions fast. Political leaders like to talk about cutting carbon emissions 80% by 2050. We think we have to cut them 80% by 2020. And that would take a major effort, but it would be centered around restructuring the tax system, lowering income taxes and raising the tax on carbon. And that would lead to a rapid restructuring of the world energy economy, a shift from oil and coal and natural gas to wind and solar and geothermal energy. We see the world building a couple of million wind turbines over the next decade by 2020. And that would be more than enough to back out the world's coal-fired power plants. Now, 2 million wind turbines sounds like a lot, but we build 70 million new cars a year. We're talking now about restructuring the energy economy to cut carbon emissions and stabilize climate. We're talking about trying to save the Greenland ice sheet. And I sort of use the Greenland ice sheet as a metaphor for civilization. If we can't save the Greenland ice sheet, and if we have to face a 23-foot rise in sea level as a result of its melting, I think civilization is in deep trouble. So this is one of the things that we think we need to do. And it's entirely doable. And then there's so many things we can do with efficiency, replacing incandescents with compact fluorescents, and now increasingly with LEDs. LEDs cut electricity use close to 90% from incandescents. And the head of Philips in North America says that by 2015, half of all the light bulbs sold in North America and Europe will be highly efficient LEDs, and by 2020 it will be 80%. So we could close at least 700 of the world's 2,400 coal-fired power plants just from lighting efficiency gains alone, which would also make money for us. It's a profitable thing to do. That's an example of the kind of thing we can do. I could talk about electrifying the transportation system and shifting to light rail in cities, high-speed inner-city rail, to plug-in hybrid cars and all-electric cars. And the idea of running a transportation system on carbon-free wind energy is really, I think, a very exciting one. Not only exciting from an environmental point of view, but economically, the cost of gasoline, the electricity equivalent of a gallon of gasoline would cost about 87 cents. So we're looking at some cheap, locally available energy as we begin to develop our wind resources.
Well, we are running out of time. What would you like to tell listeners about your new book, World on Edge?
First of all, they might want to read it. It's not only available in bookstores and on Amazon, of course, but it's also available online. So you can read it, you can download it, you can browse through it, whatever you want, free of charge. The concluding point I would make is that while we environmentalists have been talking about saving the planet, it's really civilization itself that's at stake now. And saving civilization is not a spectator sport. We all have a stake in the future, and we all need to become politically involved. I mean, we can make changes ourselves. We can go from a car to a bicycle. We can change our light bulbs. We can recycle our newspapers and so forth. But we've got to change the system now. We've got to restructure the world energy economy. And that means becoming politically active, becoming part of the movement to close down coal-fired power plants, or joining some of the groups that are working to stabilize world population, or developing a world-class recycling program in your community where you recycle almost everything. That recycling leads to enormous energy and materials savings and greatly reduces pollution. So those are the kinds of things we need to do. Each of us needs to become a political leader in our own right.
I'm Alex Smith. You have been listening to Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute and author of the new book, World on Edge, How to Prevent Environmental and Economic Collapse. Lester, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
My pleasure. The book is available on earthpolicy.org. Free of charge.
That interview with Lester Brown contains some surprises for me. For example, if LED lighting can close a quarter of all the world's coal plants, bring it on. But why does Brown keep talking about big climate legislation in the United States when we know the immediate prospects are hopeless with the new Congress and Obama waffling? EarthBeat radio reporter Daphne Wisham asked just that question during an hour-long press briefing this week. Lester Brown's reply is about the tipping points of social change and why we keep on trying.
The thing to keep in mind is that change comes very quickly and unexpectedly at times. And in thinking about social and political change, I have sort of three models that I use. One is the Pearl Harbor model, where if you'd conducted a poll on December 6, 1941, and asked the American people, should we get involved in the war or not, probably 95% would have said no, nothing doing. But if you'd asked that same question on Monday, December 8th, probably 95% would have said, yes, we have to go to war. And the thing that changed, of course, was the very successful, from a military strategic point of view, of the Japanese attack on the U.S. fleet in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. And that changed everything. Now, with climate change, for example, if we reach the point where we have a Pearl Harbor, it might be too late. Another model that I use is I call it the Berlin Wall model, where you have attitudes changing and opposition building and building and building until suddenly everything changes. And the visual manifestation of a political revolution in Eastern Europe was the Berlin Wall coming down. But the interesting thing was no one saw it coming. You can't find a single article in the political science journals written in the 1980s saying, you know, there's a big change coming in Eastern Europe. And after the wall came down, the White House called in the intelligence community leaders here in Washington and asked, you know, how come they didn't warn them about this? Well, not only could the agency not warn the administration, they had trouble explaining it after it happened. And that's what tipping points are like. They're sometimes difficult to define, but even when you define them, it's hard to tell exactly when they're coming. And I think as climate events continue to unfold, that we're going to see a major shift in public opinion despite the heavily funded climate denial campaign. At some point, it'll just become obvious to everyone. And here I go back and remember the smoking and health issue in the closing decades of the last century. And right up until the end, the tobacco company CEOs were willing to testify under oath that there was no proof of a link between smoking and health. And then suddenly everything changed almost overnight, and the industry agreed to compensate state governments to the tune of $254 billion. That's almost $1,000 for every person in the United States. And no one could have seen that or saw that coming. So change comes very quickly sometimes. I mean, in the mid-90s, there was no lobby in Washington stronger than the tobacco lobby. And now there's hardly any major lobby at all on tobacco. And don't forget that the book is online and the press release is online at earthpolicy.org.
That was Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Get a lot more green radio as free MP3 downloads from our website, ecoshock.org.
Eyewitnesses have described a wall of fast-flowing water that appeared before them like an inland tsunami.
We do need to brace ourselves for the likelihood of further bad news.
40 people were winched by helicopter from their rooftops overnight.
You have seen the awful footage from Queensland, Australia. People, cars, indeed whole towns swept away in fast-moving floods. The area impacted was the size of France and Germany combined. Three river systems filled up and powerful waters damaged the city of Brisbane. It is not the first time. In 1974, Cyclone Wanda flooded Brisbane. But in the last 12 months, flash floods hit all over the world, from Brazil through Pakistan to Sri Lanka. It is hardly normal weather, but is it climate change? From Australia, I'm pleased to have Professor Matthew England on the line. He's from the Climate Change Research Centre at the University of New South Wales in Sydney. Matthew, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Good to be with you.
We'll get to that climate question in just a minute, but to start with, what are your impressions about these Queensland floods and what it means to Australia now?
Yeah, these are very devastating floods. Brisbane is one of our largest cities in Australia. There's lots of infrastructure built up right by the river there, and the floods there are the worst since 74, and before that it was not back till early 20th century, 60, 70, 80 years ago. And even in the 30 years since the last floods, a lot of very low-lying infrastructure was built up on that river system, so there's massive damage, and of course there's been loss of life, and the whole state of Queensland is reeling from this event, and there's a massive cleanup underway as we speak.
I think people around the world are feeling for Australians at this time. What is the meteorological explanation for these floods?
Yeah, the main thing going on here for this season is a very strong La Nina event. It's probably the strongest on record, or the second, depending on how you measure a La Nina event. La Nina events are characterized by quite cool water in the central and east Pacific Ocean across towards the US, and then much warmer water north of Australia. So that's the first main reason, but there is very likely to be a climate change signal in there as well, because the waters north of Australia are particularly warm this year. They're actually the warmest ever measured. And the warmth of those waters dictates just how strong the monsoon seasons are. The fact that they're the warmest on record, it's not surprising that the summer rains up in northern Australia have been as intense as they've been.
So why do warming oceans lead to more flooding on land?
Yeah, so a warmer ocean, I mean, basically the oceans provide the energy for the monsoon system. So the rain systems that you see in the tropics over South America, over Africa and over Australia, Indonesia and so on, these very heavy rains that occur in the summertime, they're driven by the warmth of the oceans. And put simply, the warmer the oceans in the tropics, the more intense the rainfall patterns are. So if you warm the oceans, whether it's via a La Nina event, north of Australia, or via global warming, you do tend to put more moisture into the atmosphere, and that drives more intense rainfall.
We tend to think about increasing heat on land, like the Moscow fires this year, but I guess a lot of this greenhouse-caused warming is going into the sea. Are scientists monitoring these ocean temperatures around Australia on a regular basis?
Yeah, globally there's a whole program to keep a really close eye on the temperatures of the oceans, because you're right to say that global warming, a lot of the warming we trap with greenhouse gases is being absorbed by the oceans. And that's a tremendous thing, because it's actually reducing the rate of global warming on the planet dramatically. I'd argue it's also a dangerous thing, because it actually gives people a sense of complacency, in the sense that the rate of warming is relatively gradual, and there is payback. And what I mean by that is we can't just see the oceans absorb this heat without any downstream impact. And what I refer to there is firstly something like global sea level rise. As the oceans warm, they expand. But also, as we're seeing at the moment, intense floods can result from a warmer ocean. Over in North America, we saw Hurricane Katrina a couple of years ago. The energy of that storm system was driven by very warm waters in the Gulf of Mexico. They were so unusually warm that it was either a freak once in 1,000-year event, or it had to be driven by long-term climate change. So these sorts of events, increased flooding events, global sea level rise, and also effects on ecosystems with a warmer ocean. These are the sorts of things that we have to face up to as our reality for the future because of this ocean absorption of heat.
Yeah, I think you raise a really good point, because many of us may not be feeling all that hot where our weather is right now, but it just keeps building and building and building in the ocean, and we expect 50, 100 years from now this heat is still going to be coming out of the seas. Is that correct?
Yeah, look, people are still, this issue is complicated, because even the fact that we have a seasonal cycle on the planet, you mentioned the cold weather that parts of the US and North America and Canada and Europe have experienced this winter. I mean, every single year we have a summer and winter cycle, and psychologists have surveyed people, and coming out of summer, you know, the acceptance of global warming science is markedly higher than when people come out of winter, and that's ridiculous in some sense, because we know that the seasonal cycle has been there since the planet first formed billions and billions of years ago. The seasonal cycle does not change the basic science of global warming. A cold winter here or there is what we expect to continue seeing, but the overall picture of a gradually warming planet, decade by decade, a warming planet is what we're expecting to see, and it's exactly what we've seen for the past century and what we're projecting to see over the next century, unless emissions of greenhouse gases come right down.
Professor England, the floods are surprising some of us outside Australia. We just absorb the images of long-standing drought and bushfires. How can global warming cause drought and flooding?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. The way global warming will work, and all of the models agree on this on a kind of global scale, is that the tropics will tend to get wetter as we go forward in time, and we've seen that. An example of that over Brazil and parts of Queensland and Northern Australia this summer. Whereas in the subtropics, and what I mean by that is that's the sort of latitudes of about 30 to 40 south and 30 to 40 north, those latitude bands are expected to dry progressively over the next 50 to 100 years. And then further towards the high latitudes, like up towards 50, 60 north and 50, 60 south, we're seeing increased precipitation. That's a bit of a mouthful for your listeners to digest, but the bottom line, the shorter way to put this is that the world's hydrological cycle is expected to be enhanced and increased and invigorated under global warming. And the average hydrological cycle is one of high rainfall at the tropics. We have the desert latitudes at about 30 to 40 or 30 south, 30 north, and then we have much higher rainfall at about 60 south and 60 north. Now, those latitude bands of high rain, low rain, high rain, we're expecting them to be even enhanced. So where it's already wet now, it'll be even wetter. Where it's dry, it'll tend to be drier. So for Australia, the example you mentioned, by and large, the region south, along the south of Australia, so parts of Victoria, where we had severe bushfires only a couple of years ago of the order of 50 or so fatalities. That part of Australia, by and large, we're expecting to become drier. To the north in the tropics, we're expecting to become wetter. And this will progress gradually, and of course there are always year-to-year variations. The current La Nina has seen a downpour of rain over Victoria, where only 2 years ago they had severe bushfires, and this is just a La Nina cycle superimposed on the long-term average. So people are forever confusing long-term trends, decade-by-decade trends, with year-to-year variations, and even the seasonal cycle. I mean, there's nothing more ridiculous than hearing a radio commentator here in Australia or elsewhere come along on a cold day and say, gee, it's a cold day, where's global warming today? This is just such a misunderstanding and a confusion between weather, which is day-to-day variations, and climate, which is the long-term, decade-to-decade progression of the climate system.
Yeah, I'd expect my dog or cat to make that mistake, but hopefully not humans. We know that winter and summer come, but the overall pattern of it is what we're talking about with climate change. Now, the business newspapers mainly reported on the loss of coal exports as railways flooded out. I wonder, what will it take before Australians themselves demand an end to coal exports to save what's left of a dependable climate? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it was a really ironic aspect of this that some of the coal mines actually flooded as well, and there was a sort of a ceasing of operations there for a while, and I mean a lot of businesses were hit, but to see Australia still so reliant on coal and to see the rate at which politicians are pushing forward changes on that front is concerning. Australia has among the highest per capita emissions of greenhouse gases on this planet. And the time for us to position for a new economy with low carbon technologies, solar power, for example, is a fantastic potential resource here for Australia. You know, the time for us to move to these technologies is now. And, you know, we can't wait for other nations to change. The writing's on the wall that the world economy is going to go towards low carbon. So there are some very, very good policymakers trying to push this through at the moment in Australia, trying to convince the electorate that the way to go is to put a price on carbon and to drive innovation in the renewable energy sector. I've been on a report recently that's being submitted directly to the Prime Minister and Cabinet that makes these very specific recommendations about trying to position for a low-carbon economy for the future, securing Australia's climate. We already live in a very harsh environment for our climate. If we go on in a climate change world, we're going to see even more extremes and more costly infrastructure required to deal with things like severe droughts and bushfires and floods and so on. So there are moves in the right direction by people with all the right intentions. My concern is that we still have the electorate, you know, when it comes to elections here in Australia, we still have politicians getting pretty short sound bites in there, like, you know, say no to a carbon tax and let's not put a price on carbon. This is just the government's ripping you off. There's a real fear campaign out there trying to derail the process, and it's having an effect because the average person on the street doesn't necessarily appreciate the scale of the climate problem. They don't appreciate the kind of costs we're going to have in the future, and they also have a fear that a price on carbon will ruin the economy, when in fact folks like Nick Stern and Ross Gunnow here in Australia have shown that putting a price on carbon should drive a growth in the economy, not hamper progress.
Really, it would be beautiful to see Australia powered by all that solar power that you do have, and to be a world leader in exporting, sustainable energy instead of coal. Our guest has been Professor Matthew England from the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Mix yourself some industrial stew, slop it all over your lovely land, and then export it to others. That's the plan, and when you're done, you'll be extinct. I mean gone, like the dinos and the dodos. So how'd we get into this awful mess? I mean, can't we rely on scientists? Tell us how to stay away from trouble and fix those problems on the double. I mean, why not have solar and wind power, electric cars, ecological farms? Well, you know, big business is slow to change, and to slow things more, they try to arrange it. So politicians owe them lots for getting elected and being big shots. At least they act like big shots. You and I know who pulls their chains. So if an oil company owns a president, he ain't likely to call for disarmament, because there's nothing big oil likes more than war. What else are all those big vehicles for than riding all over the desert, dropping bombs, all looking for one guy? I mean, 200,000 soldiers all out looking for one guy. John Wayne must be rolling in his grave. Now the problem in the rest of the global village is that nobody's looking at the dire image of oceans rising and forests burning. I mean, why think of that when you're all yearning for a trip to Cuba or someplace else warm, like Tuk to Yuk Tuk?
It feels like a giant spider is making a web all over the world. The system is growing everywhere. Billions of people rush from sustainable lives in the countryside to slums, factory jobs, and refrigerators. Strangely, this development matrix seems to be collapsing in the center in America, just as it surges into life everywhere else. And there is an emptiness that invites us all to escape. I did, for a while. William Powers did, and who is he? Google tells me about an American from Long Island, an international development and aid worker in poorer countries, a man concerned with the extinction of people, languages, and nature. William Powers' writing appears in the New York Times, The Atlantic, and many other places. He's got degrees from Brown University and Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He's even worked for the World Bank, and we'll forgive him for that. Bill is now a senior fellow at the World Policy Institute. But William Powers had to leave all that to find himself in a 12-by-12 cabin in North Carolina, a place with no power, no address, and a creek with no name. Bill, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock. I've been reading your new book, 12x12, with interest and a little sadness because I badly miss my own self-built cabin on the hill in a wild spot of Canada. I spent 10 years off the grid. So why was this cabin just 12x12?
Well, the 12 by 12, 12 feet by 12 feet dimensions has to do with the fact that if it's more than 12 by 12, you are legally required in the state of North Carolina to install plumbing and electricity and also to pay property taxes. If it's 12 by 12 or smaller, you don't have to do any of that. So it's a great way to extract yourself from the system.
I wanted to ask you, too, you've had lots of opportunities. You could have done almost anything, but you went back to live in a small cabin before writing this book, 12 by 12. Why did you do that?
Part of it was because of coming back after 10 years abroad, you know, working in so-called developing countries around the world, indigenous cultures, on conservation and aid projects, and then realizing that the very heart of the system, the heart of environmental destruction, is my own country. It was like discovering the thief, and the thief was me. And it was a feeling of guilt and a feeling of, you know, how do we change this system? And it was at that point when I met a very inspiring physician who I call Jackie Benton in the book 12 by 12. Actually, her name is different, but she asked me to change it to protect her privacy. And she's a physician who could earn, you know, over $250,000 a year, but she only accepts a small amount of that, gives the rest back to the hospital, and is living a subsistence lifestyle right in the middle of the U.S. in a 12 by 12 cabin.
So is it still possible to escape from the heart of empire?
Well, it's not the 1800s, and you can't really be Thoreau going back to Walden Pond. As I found out, living for a season in her 12 by 12, you could smell the waft from the chicken factories, the stench of that, and you could hear this sonic boom of military jets flying right over the cabin, rippling No Name Creek. So you can't extract yourself from globalization. But what you can do is become a wildcrafter. You know, you can begin to shape your hobbies, your profession, and your community in harmony with the biosphere's limits. And that's what I discovered in, you know, as you say, backwater North Carolina, was that in the old sort of plantations where there used to be slaves and then tobacco, those have become empty spaces, and people are filling those empty spaces with organic farms and permaculture experiments and all kinds of exciting things. And they're living on the creative edge of balancing the human need to do things and to be social and to create, but they're doing it in a way that's in harmony with nature.
I want to get back to that positive side in just a minute, because it's so easy to characterize Americans, to put down America. But in fact, in my travels and in all of the 48 states, I met wonderful, kind people who looked after me. So, you know, I'm always keeping that in mind when I talk about these things. But I couldn't escape the death culture. Even in Canada, I had a uranium mine near me with tailing ponds not too far from the cabin, and there were a lot of reminders. You did talk in your book about the chicken culture. I mean, it's making us fat, and these factory farms are pretty terrible. Could you compare just briefly those birds' lives in the dark with the wild and domestic birds you met in North Carolina?
Right. So I had the unfortunate pleasure, you might say, of visiting one of these chicken factories, part of the gold-kissed empire, Pilgrim's Pride. And these chickens live in absolutely horrid conditions in the darkness for 28 days or 35 days until they're slaughtered. And it's absolutely something you definitely do not want to see. In contrast, my neighbors, the Thompsons, who live next to the 12 by 12 and a little farm that they've started there, they were raising a genetic variety of free-range chickens, which they were selling. And it was just, you know, the contrast could not be greater, you know. And I said to people, like, if you're ever even thinking about buying non-free-range organic chicken at the supermarket, I mean, think again. You know, even though you have to pay a little bit more, or maybe even quite a bit more, maybe buy a little bit less and eat less and be a little bit healthier by eating less and just enjoying every bite and knowing that in every bite you're actually supporting this other kind of a vision.
Well, you've gone way ahead to something I really wanted to ask you about, which is using the household budget. You talk about decolonizing from the matrix in a way, and your friend said declare independence from the corporate global economy with the household budget. How can we do that?
Right. Well, I believe that it's definitely possible to vote, and not just with your ballots on election day, but to vote with your dollars for the kind of world you want to live in. So the household budget, every single penny that you spend is either saying yes to a sustainable, durable, soft world, or it's saying yes to a flat world, a world that rewards monoculture and a one-world uniplanet. You have that power every time you open your wallet. So that's the point. It's a kind of a obvious point in a way, but a lot of people kind of forget about it because it's so easy just to kind of buy that fast food or go to Walmart or whatever it is. But imagine that you could, over this next year, think about each dollar you're spending. You know, each time you spend something, just think about, okay, what kind of world is this voting for? And then making the right choices. Even on the web, you know, you can buy on ETSY.com, you can buy from local artisans instead of buying from big box store. And there's neighborgoods.net where you're exchanging goods with your neighbors instead of going out and buying new stuff.
Well, I may have to give up on Amazon now that they've abandoned WikiLeaks, but that's just my politics. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest and author, aid worker, William Powers. We are chewing over his latest book, 12 by 12, A One-Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream. Now, another thing I found in your book, Bill, was the importance of happiness and that those with the most stuff don't necessarily have that happiness. Can you talk to us about that?
That's right. So we often think that money buys happiness, but if you look at the science, the social science behind it, it doesn't. Happiness peaks at a gross domestic product of around $9,000, the level of Chile, Puerto Rico, other countries like that. After that, it plateaus. So for each additional unit of economic growth, you're not getting more well-being for the population. So we have to ask ourselves, what's an economy for anyway? You know, is it just to create more economic throughput and more money for the richest people? And by the way, here in New York City, where I'm talking to you right now, the wealthiest person last year made $6 billion. He's a hedge fund trader. You know, that's something like $2,000 an hour. No, it's more than that. It's a lot of money. Or do we want to be creating something else?
I was thinking when I was living at the edge of the woods, we worked really hard all summer. We could make a few bucks when there were some tourists around, and we had to grow all our food and put it away and then get that wood pile ready and stacked up. But then the whole community wasted away that long winter. We were visiting and drinking tea and daydreaming and talking by the fireside. Hardly anybody has the time to think anymore. And maybe that's why we don't. Do you think there's a conspiracy to use up every second of our lives?
There's a definite time poverty in our culture, and we have to find ways to create time wealth. And there's a lot of ways to do that. One is by, and I jokingly say, that you should work 24/7, meaning 24 hours a week, 7 months a year. You know, and that's 24/7 is a good rule of thumb. See if you can set up your life in a way that the streams of income that you have are enough in just working 24 hours a week, 7 months a year, to meet your expenses. A lot of people I know are doing that. And that's a huge act of rebellion, to take back your time, to find this leisure ethic that people are living with around the world in your own lives. There's no reason why we can't do it in our own society. I've been doing that recently, and I've really been scaling back my work creating time. And part of it is like what you're saying, what you saw in that cabin when you were living out there is what I saw also in the 12 by 12, is the fact that people have a lot of free time. And the other thing is also in subsistence cultures, because I worked for 10 years in subsistence cultures, the average campesino or farmer, independent farmer in a developing country like Guatemala or Bolivia, they actually are not slaving away as people are commonly associating. They tend to work rather short hours and also according to their whim. So a certain day they might, you know, put up the poles for a new house. The next day, I kind of feel like harvesting some corn, whatever it is. So the work they're doing is actually just spontaneously in accordance with their soul, what they feel like doing at that time. And I think actually one of the greatest things about the 21st century economy is that we actually do have a lot of that independence now because there's so much sort of outsourcing and there's ways of integrating your skills into the economy in ways that allow you to have that freedom and flexibility.
24/7, I'm going to remember that. You worked in Bolivia helping to build a community there in the deep Amazon, and Pachamama is the new movement code word that I'm hearing even in the climate movement. What does that really mean to the original people who believe in it?
Pachamama is the Mother Earth. So in Quechua and Aymara cosmology, it's the supreme god, which is our own planet, our host planet that sustains us. So for example, in Bolivia, and I lived for 6 years in Bolivia, whenever you take a drink, you first pour a little bit onto the ground, and then you take a drink because you're offering a little bit to Pachamama first. Everyone does this. And in fact, nowadays, even here in the States, I always just dip my finger in the drink and then just like sort of squirt a little bit onto the ground. I don't want to pour it onto someone's rug, you know. But I continue that practice of honoring Pachamama.
Well, that leads to something else I've been puzzled about. Life has been very good to me. I've had unbelievable opportunities. I've found love, and I'm often happy despite all the horrible things I know are going on in the world. So my question, Bill Powers, and you talk about this in the book, do we have to believe in God to be religious, to be grateful? And if not, who or what are we being grateful to?
No, we don't have to believe in a monotheistic God. But yes, gratefulness is important. I think we're grateful for the present moment, for life itself, for the spontaneous manifestation of so many forms around us, yourself, your loved ones, the planet, everything. That doesn't have to be theistic. In fact, the three major monotheistic religions are tied in with the advent of reading silently. Like the ability to read without moving your lips is a relatively recent thing that started in the Middle Ages. And the voice in our heads today, like that you probably are quite well aware of, this continuous loop of mind, is tied with that ability. So I think in some ways, you know, the major religions, they're the religions of the book, you know, of the book, of the word. And I think in some ways, like, the original religion, or the true spirituality, is beneath the word. It's what my friend David Abram calls becoming animal. That's his new book. It's called Becoming Animal. It's the idea of coming back into our carnality, into our bodies, and perceiving the world through that, and not just through our mind.
Another step that I really identified with that you took in the book was the need to keep an eye for self-criticism as we journey towards this more meaningful life. I've met some pretty self-satisfied alternative type people, and I've kind of been that person myself, even though we've only taken baby steps. How can we keep that humility to know our real and very limited role in our short time here on Earth?
Well, one thing is you can practice rule number six. And rule number six is don't take yourself so damn seriously. And if you ask me what rules one through five are, rules one through five are C rule number six. So the idea is, you know, lighten up. We don't need to take ourselves so seriously. That's part of what Dr. Jackie Benton taught me that I talk about in 12 by 12, you know, the fact that you can just become simple. The classic Taoist master is a very ordinary person. Dr. Benton's an ordinary person. You might meet her and you might just think she's no one special, you know, but she's a master. And I think it just comes from just being a creature among creatures. You know, it comes from watching nature. Everything else has its place, you know, and just be ordinary.
And Dr. Benton, despite her giving life of caring for poor people, had established a very low effort but expressive garden all around your 12 by 12 cabin. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Right, like she didn't want gardening to become another ego extension, like, oh, look at my amazing heirloom tomatoes. Instead, it was more like an expression of simplicity. You know, she did have 100 or 200 varieties of crops growing, but it was done in a way through permaculture design that things would shade each other out to prevent weeds. A lot of it was mostly native plants that don't need a whole lot of irrigation and so on. So she was actually able to travel for periods of time and everything was on autopilot. So she didn't want to become the burden of her garden. It's like Thoreau said, you know, someone tried to offer Thoreau a welcome mat for his cabin at Walden, just like a little doormat. And he said he refused it. And he said, I'd have to shake it out if I had that. You know, and she's got the same idea that really it's about simplicity, both in your possessions and also in your hobbies.
The other thing I found in my time in my cabin was that I experienced absolute silence from time to time, and I claim that few city dwellers have ever heard it. When the snow was 8 feet deep, there was nothing around me. There were no planes flying overhead. I couldn't hear any highway noise, and I had no electricity, so there were no machines coming on and off in my house. Absolute silence, and it's so good, I can still hear it now.
Oh, it is so wonderful. Alex, I can hear it as well, and it is such a blessing to have that time. I experienced it in Africa when I was living in these remote villages, South America, in the 12 by 12, and it's divine.
You left that 12 by 12 cabin in North Carolina. Why and where did you go?
Well, you know, some things are just meant to touch our lives for a certain period of time, and I spent one season there, and then I went back to doing aid work. Went back to West Africa for a period, went back to Bolivia, And then I started working at a think tank in New York City to try to bring to scale some of these ideas. In fact, part of what I do now is I bring this discussion of what's your 12 by 12 to audiences. Just now, I just came out of a lecture with Fulbright scholars from other countries here in the U.S., and I'm taking that message around to people and using this institute as kind of a megaphone for getting some of these ideas out there. So it's like I honestly find it very seductive and would love to still be out there in a way, but I just feel like listening to myself and knowing what my role is, it's not to be there right now.
I tell myself I came back to fight the dragon in its own place. Does that resonate with you at all?
You know, the idea of fighting the dragon is a bit problematic because as soon as you fight something, you're energizing it through that negative energy or that like resistance. So I think that really part of what I learned in the 12 by 12 and also for indigenous cultures is if you can bring about another consciousness level where you're not fighting it, but you're just kind of creating something new, it's much more powerful. So she would say, where do you grab the dragon's tail? You know, so it's like, I picture that as like many people, hundreds of people each grabbing the tail somewhere. So it's kind of not a direct fighting, but you're sort of holding on and coming together to do that.
As we finish up, is there something more you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, just that it's very difficult to escape your habits. And a lot of people probably feel like, you know, I like my life, or it's good. But it's good to remember two things. One is that if everyone lived at the level of the average North American, Canadians and Americans, we'd need 4 or 5 additional planets to sustain everyone, you know? And also the fact that we're losing a culture every fortnight around the world, you know, because of the globalization model. That's one thing. And the other is there's a lot of joy to be found in simplifying. You know, bust your clutter, get down to the basics, simplify. You'll find have much more time and freedom to be yourself and to give to others, and you'll be more happy. So there's two things. One is the negative thing, that it's not sustainable, this Western lifestyle. And two is there's a better way. So why not try it out? Some of the things that we've been talking about that you talk about in your other programs, start implementing those one by one, and that's how we'll see the change happen.
Living outside the machine. I'm still poring over a couple of chapters of your book, Bill, and the handy sayings inside. It's William Powers with a new book, 12 by 12, A One-Room Cabin Off the Grid and Beyond the American Dream. It's pretty cheap in paperback and the kind of book that you want to pass around to friends. Find out more at Bill's website, williampowers.com. Thank you, Bill. And
yeah, actually, it's williampowersbooks.com.
Oh, williampowersbooks.com. Okay,
yeah.
We got that. And thanks so much. And keep Radio EcoShock in mind if you have another story for us, would you?
I will certainly do that, Alex. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. I'm Alex Smith. Our website is EcoShock.org.
Now, maybe this makes you all kind of shocked, and you ask, why doesn't our government act? But I already told you they're told what to do by corporations more powerful than you. So maybe you should start to protest. I mean, yell at those guys. A whole lot of them. And there's lots of practical things you can do, like sell your car and buy walking shoes, shop organic, ride a bike, buy local produce, and learn more too. Find out who makes all the bad decisions and get rid of them right now.
That song, Talking Global Warming, was by longtime musical activist Smokey Dimney. Smokey spends winters performing in Ontario, Canada, before returning to his bicycle shop on Quadra Island, British Columbia. The fiddler is Anne Lindsay, well-known in Canada, the arrangement by Kevin Barrett of the Kevin Barrett Jazz Group. Google Smokey Dimney, that's D-Y-M-N-Y, to find out more, and for heaven's sakes, buy a CD to keep him going. We need more people music.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
We'll close out with a snippet of Dana Pearson.
I mean, people, think about the road we're on right now. All the wars over oil, all the power grabs. Well, the world's going to hell and the planet burns. Oceans are rising while we pollute our precious water. Blowing up our mountains, destroying our oceans too.